a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
For the Health and Human Services Committee, I would like to welcome our listeners out there in South Dakota and welcome the people that are here in the room. Just a reminder, if you're going to speak before this committee, please sign in and the secretary will call the roll.
Bradford?
Here.
Holine?
Here.
Krebs? Rave?
Here.
Schleckaway?
Here.
Cross?
Here.
Hanhoff?
Here. Thank you. We have a quorum present. Senator Krebs has an absent excuse. She's in attending a meeting out of state. With that, on our first meeting, we had an overview by the Department of Health and the Department of Health and Human Services. But the secretary is reminding me that we need to approve the minutes. So with that, I would entertain a motion.
I'll move. Second.
Moved by Senator Ray, seconded by Senator Schleckaway. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carried. Thank you. As I was saying, we did have presentations. I had asked those committees that primarily have bills to do an overview for us. They received a letter, an overview of their programming. Then secondly, to address how they meet those individuals that we always refer to that we need to take care of in South Dakota. And then the last piece was to address how they see themselves and fitting in health care reform. As we know today on the 14th of January, who knows what's going to happen. So with that this morning, I would like to invite Kim Malsom-Risden, who is the new secretary. She has a history with the department, and we welcome her. And I will say to all the members, we are on a time frame here. We do not need to go as long, but I want to adjourn by 11:15. So with that, welcome.
Thank you very much, Senator and Chairperson Hunhoff. My name is Kim Malsom-Risden, and I'm the Secretary of the Department of Social Services. I've been in this role now for 5 days, and prior to serving as Secretary, I was the Deputy Secretary for the Department for 5.5 years under the leadership of Deb Bowman. So I'm very pleased to be here. We have some folks with us, though, to help answer any questions that you might have, whether that's today or in the future. Please feel free to call anyone. One of us, and we will try to get in any help that you need. Behind me here is our Deputy Secretary, Lynn Valenti. Lynn joined our department here just this week and came to us from the Bureau of Personnel, where she was the General Counsel. And before serving in that role, Lynn was the General Counsel out at the Department of Human Services, which is where we first met and worked together. So we're very pleased to have Lynn on board. Next to her is Brenda Tidball-Zeltinger. Brenda is our Chief Financial Officer and has been with us now for several years, and prior to that worked for the Department of Human Services, too. Next to her is Larry Iverson. Larry is the Director of our Division of Medical Services, which administers our state Medicaid plan. So we have lots of names for Larry. We'll save those for a later date.
Medicaid wizard.
That's a kind one, Senator Rave. Next is Terry Walter. Terry is our Director of the Division of Child Support. And so deals with a lot of people. We're going to talk about those kinds of details as we get into the presentation. Marilyn Kinsman is next. Marilyn is the director of our Adult Services and Aging Division, and we'll talk a little bit about what she and all of her staff do. We've got some exciting things that we are excited about that we're doing in that arena. Virginia Weisler is our Director of Child Protection Services and honestly has one of the toughest jobs in state government. This is the agency that intervenes when there are safety concerns of children related to abuse or neglect. And so they are, we'll talk a little bit more detail about what they do on a daily basis as well. Carrie Johnson is next. Carrie is our Division Director for Economic Assistance. And so that's the division that actually most customers of our department come into contact with. They deal with the biggest volume of people because they administer most of the financial benefit programs that we have. Lastly is Pat Munson. Pat is our Director of Child Care Services. And so, as you can imagine, we support a lot of families who are working and who need assistance with paying for their child care so that they can keep working. And so Pat's division does that as well as works with child care providers. With that, I believe you all have the handout that we have that has a variety of information. And if I may, I'll just kind of start with that. the thing that I would lead off with is that just by the nature of what you heard with introductions, we're a very large agency. We impact 1 in 6 South Dakotans in a given year for a variety of ways. And so we come into contact with many, many citizens across the state. We have a $935 million budget, and so we manage many, many different federal funding sources. Obviously, general funds are a big part of our budget as well, but there's a lot of complexity. We answer to a lot of federal regulations in addition to any state regulations that we might have flexibility within, so quite a bit of complexity there, but it kind of is what it is. We'd like to start off with our vision and mission statement relative to what we do on a daily basis, and that is try to build strong families, which we see as South Dakota's foundation in our future. That's the key hinge of our strategic plan, and we're going to talk about some of the goals that we are working on right now relative to that. But in our world, strong families are really the heart of what we do. We try to strengthen families so that they don't have to interact with the Department of Social Services. For those of you who know my predecessor, Deb Bowman, she would say, and we feel this is still the case, that most people don't wake up on any given day and say, I can't wait to go interact with the Department of Social Services or go knock on their door and ask for help. That's not who South Dakotans are. It's not a reflection on us, we hope, but it's not who South Dakotans are. And so our everything that we do is geared towards strengthening people and their families so that they don't have to come into contact with us. And that's through all of the things that we do on a daily basis. Families mean a lot of different things depending on the person's circumstances. And so please don't misunderstand. We work with families of all different constitutions, whether that's the single elderly person who's trying to stay in their home, stay close to their family members, but it's just them, all the way to two-parent families where the parents are both working and the kids need some health insurance or they're not going to be able to go to the doctor. So families mean a variety of things, and we try to support them all within our department. Our mission statement is down at the bottom. It's pretty comprehensive there and tries to, I think, capture, you know, a little bit of what we do on a day-in and day-out basis. But fostering independence and personal responsibility is first on our mission statement for a reason. Do the work that we do to give people the skills that they need so that they can be independent of our agency. The other thing I would mention maybe at this point, Madam Chair, is that we're more than happy to take questions as you have them or however you'd like to do that. So please don't have any problems interrupting me. Our guiding principles are on slide 3. Again, a part of our strategic plan. These have been in place now for approximately 5 years when we developed a comprehensive strategic plan for the department, and these remain relevant today. I won't walk through all of them, but I would just point out a couple of them because they are really important to how we operate. First and foremost, you see that first one about families having the right to be safe and secure. We feel that it's an essential function of our department is to ensure that vulnerable people, and those are sometimes children in families, sometimes older adults or adults with disabilities who are vulnerable, have the right to be safe and secure. And so we play that critical function within state government to assist in those kinds of situations. The other guiding principle I would point out is that last one, and that's the no wrong door approach. Obviously, you know, we do, in fact, serve 1 in 6 people in a given year, but we actually interact with even more people within our state because sometimes people come to us with needs that we aren't able to help them with directly. We get people to community resources when those are available or to other state agencies, and that's really that no wrong door. We strive to do that day in and day out, and we're doing some targeted initiatives really relative to this, particularly in our adult services area. Slide 4 starts to go into a little bit of detail about our department's goals and kind of what we're striving to do. But what I would alert you to is you also have a one-page handout here that has a little bit more detail. This is a snapshot, if you will, of what our strategic plan is, and it includes our our guiding principles and our goals, as well as our objectives and strategies. And so it gives you a sense of that. If you have questions about any of that level of detail, we'd be happy to answer them. But what we thought would be important to talk through is just some of those overall goal areas that we feel are important for the work that we do. That first one is increasing access to quality service for our customers. This is a goal that has remained relatively consistent now for the last 5 years, although we're working on different strategies to do this. But as you can all, I'm sure, appreciate, making sure that people, whether they live in the northwest corner of the state or the city of Sioux Falls, there are different levels of services available. Whether that's from our agency or through the providers that provide services that we contract with. And so making sure that people have reasonable access no matter where they live is something that is high on our priority list. And so we're doing a variety of things in that area. One of the things I would point out as a strategy that is new within the last couple of years is we have recently partnered with tribes across the state, as well as the Indian Health Service and Urban Indian Health, to come together in a tribal consultation process for Medicaid so that we can work on strategies to ensure that tribes and IHS are accessing as many federal dollars as they possibly can. That's a way of increasing access to services if those service systems have, you know, the dollars that they can get from the federal government. So we've been, that's an example of the kind of thing that falls under there. The second goal is to reduce abuse, neglect, and exploitation of vulnerable people. Again, that's probably not surprising when you think about what we do and some of our guiding principles. This is geared obviously towards children and also adults. And so we're going to be visiting with you all later in session about some enhancements that we'd like to see relative to the structure for reporting of abuse of adults. And so that would fall, again, under this kind of goal area within our department. Slide 5 has the other three major goals that our department's working on. The third one is to improve customer service. Again, this has been a consistent goal area of ours, again, because we serve so many people and we are a large agency, so we will probably always be seeking to improve the customer service that we provide and feel that we've made good gains in this area, but we want to always do better. Managing internal processes and procedures to achieve our mission. This is the kind of stuff that a large agency or any agency for that matter really needs to do its job well. We need strong statutes that support what we do and what we need to do. We need administrative rules that reflect current and anticipated practice. We need policies. We need technology. This is kind of the backbone and the infrastructure that lets our agency do its work. The last one there is really geared towards our employees, and this is a goal area that we recently broke out to make sure that we are giving due diligence to supporting the employees that we have across the state in all 64 offices and making sure that they have the skills and the training and the competencies necessary to do the best work that they can do. Slide 6 gives you a snapshot of our organizational structure. Many of you are probably somewhat familiar with this, but for what it's worth, we have 9 divisions within our department. 3 of those divisions you see off to the left-hand side, and those are really our supportive divisions to the divisions that provide more of that direct service. So we have our Division of Finance. That's headed by Brenda Tidball-Zeltinger, who I introduced, and includes folks that manage a lot of federal funding sources and a lot of reporting and just a lot of processes associated with paying the bills. Our Division of Legal Services is headed by Dan Todd. Dan is not here with us today. He's back holding down the fort. We provide some specialty legal services to across the state. One area of this would be where we support local state's attorneys in prosecutions of criminal child abuse and neglect because, fortunately, that doesn't happen every day. And so we have some special expertise in that area that we go out and help local state's attorneys handle those kinds of cases. The third area there is our Division of Operations and Technology. Again, we have field offices located across the state. We have large technology projects and systems that support all of our operations, and so we have several staff in that division that help us make sure we're attending to those needs. That division's headed by Mark Close, and he is also back at the office today. The six divisions off to the right are the divisions that really provide those direct services, and we're going to get into kind of some of those details here in a minute. The next slide is a map of where we do have offices. We serve 64 communities through our office structure. 35 of those are served on a full-time basis, and the remainder are served itinerantly based on the needs of people in those communities. Slide 8 tells us more, a little bit about really the Office of the Secretary and has the number of staff that we have. We have 995.5 budgeted FTE within the department. And so the Office of the Secretary provides administration and direction overall, and particularly in those areas such as finance, legal, operations, and technology. Slide 9 talks about some other things that fall under the Office of the Secretary. So we have our administrative hearings office. We actually have two administrative law judges within our department that handle appeals of decisions that our department has made specific to the programs that we administer. They also hear any other Medicaid-related appeals because our agency is the Medicaid state agency, and so when we have other departments that have made decisions on behalf of Medicaid, this group would hear any appeals of those as well. Our constituent liaison services is it's a one-person shop, and that person is Valerie Porter Hansen. Valerie answers between 500 and 1,000 calls a month from Medicaid recipients who have questions about either bills that they're receiving or services that they are wondering if they're covered. She is really the person that's a resource to recipients to get those basic questions answered. They might want to change their primary care provider. She helps them with those and helps people kind of get on their way and helps clear some bumps in the road that way. Information and statistical services, we have one person in our office who really supports all divisions, and including the secretary's office, with compiling. He does a lot of federal reports, but also just helps us maintain a large volume of data. Victim Services is another part of the Office of the Secretary. This program actually has two main parts. One is the Victims Compensation Program. That's where victims of certain crimes may be eligible for financial reimbursement for expenses related to that crime. So this program administers that, as well as works with all the domestic violence shelters across the state and other related service programs in administering some federal grants that we have there. So that's the Office of the Secretary. At this point, we'd like to start off with some of the divisions that serve children primarily. First is our Division of Child Protection Services. As we talked, this division is concerned with making sure that children are safe, hopefully within their families, and if they can't be with their families, in other family-like or other kinds of settings. So that division serves families referred due to safety concerns. This is abuse, neglect, sexual abuse, emotional abuse. We also serve the kinship, foster, and adoptive families that we might end up having to place a child because they can't be safe at home. So what I would tell you is it is our highest priority to see kids stay with their families. We support families to become safe. We work with them to develop safety plans whenever possible. We will bring in extended family to support that, that family that child's in to do what they can to keep kids there. Unfortunately, that can't always be the case, and then we do have to look at other options. We always look at family first. When a child can't remain at home, sometimes a child's needs, however, are such that we have to look at non-family settings, and we will do that as well. The numbers that you see down there give you a snapshot of what we're dealing with in a given year. These numbers have remained fairly consistent, at least over the last 5 years, where we, on average, receive about 15,000 reports of abuse or neglect. of those, we have a screening process that determines, you know, what our next action may need to be or not need to be. And so of the 15,000 reports that we get in a given year, last year we investigated or did assessments in about 26% of those cases. So that number has remained fairly consistent as well. Once we do an assessment, we're going to, you know, hopefully be able to direct or provide some services, whether that's through contract providers or us directly, again, with the goal of keeping those kids at home, but first and foremost, safe. The numbers below, the average of, at any given time, we have 1,200 kids in paid placement. That includes children that are in foster care. Kinship care, which is a family arrangement, but where we're making a payment to help offset those costs. It also includes group care facilities, where a child can't be in a family setting, but can be served there. It also includes children that are in psychiatric residential treatment facilities across our state. So that number is that entire population. Slide 11 there has some more detail. One of the things that has kind of been an emerging trend that we're actually pleased about is, you know, when we're always trying to keep kids with families, and if it can't be the family that they are growing up in, it can it be other relatives. Adoption is sometimes a situation that we see other families able to step up and kind of complete that so that a child has permanency. But sometimes subsidized guardianship is another permanent option for children where it's another family member. An adoption maybe isn't the best legal solution, but a guardianship is. And so we are pleased to see families able to play that role in a child's life as well. And so that's the number that you see at the top. Our Division of Child Protection Services also licenses all the foster homes that we do have, and we have about 750 of those as of last month. And we license other services that are provided to children as well. CPS has staff located in 21 communities throughout the state, but they provide statewide coverage wherever that might be. What I told the House Health and Human Services Committee yesterday and that I would share with you as well is this is a group of extremely dedicated, really hardworking staff. These are folks that are called out, 365 days a year, all hours of the day, to accompany law enforcement to some really scary and oftentimes very sad situations. So I give them a tremendous amount of credit for the dedication that they have. They are generally not very appreciated by the general public. And so the Division of Child Support is our next division. Child support impacts a number, almost 50,000 families in a given year, where we are helping those families get the financial resources that that they need so that those children have what is owed to them as they grow up. The one thing I would tell you is that it's because of our relationship with helping families access those child support payments. People often think that we get involved with child custody and child visitation issues, and that actually is not the role that this division plays. I understand why that's confusing to people. I think it's also frustrating when they call us and we tell them that's really not a matter that we can deal with, but for whatever that's worth, you might get people that confuse that as well. The Division of Child Support does a variety of things in addition just to helping collect the money and dispersing the money. They help locate non-custodial parents, and they do an excellent job at that. They help establish paternity where that's in question. They help enforce things like health insurance so that it's not just the dollars that get come to the children in need, but it's, you know, when there's been a court order that a non-custodial parent cover health insurance costs, we help make that happen as well. You'll see at kind of the middle or towards the bottom of the page, our Division of Child Support has been recognized as the number one child support enforcement agency for the 10th consecutive year. And we'd like to give Terry Walter a lot of flack about that. He's been known to wear a crown on a few days of the year for his king-like status. But it's really a testament to the hard work that Terry and all of his staff do day in and day out, just doing an excellent job on behalf of families in South Dakota. So they are located in 8 communities throughout the state and, again, provide statewide coverage. Slide 13 there includes some information, kind of a visual of what their caseload trends have looked like. Again, You know, we're seeing an increase not only in the number of cases that we handle, but obviously in the dollars that that we collect on behalf of families. Our division of Child Care Services is next. What we'll start off there is obviously our Division of Child Care Services helps low-income families access child care through the assistance through subsidy payments. In an average month, we serve about 3,000 families who have about 5,200 children among them. When we do provide a child care subsidy to a family, we actually make that payment directly to the provider that family chooses. So that's how that arrangement works. We also obviously interact with child care providers across the state, and you see some numbers there where we license or register those providers. And then we also help parents that are seeking information about child care or other items. This is an area within our department where we have some fun supportive programs for families. We have our child care our child seat program, where we help low-income families actually get a child safety seat or a booster seat. And then we partner with some agencies who run clinics across the state to help make sure those seats are installed correctly. We have a really high rate of incorrect installation of child care seats, and so we are trying to make some inroads in that regard. It's really important to the health of kids. Senator Rave would know probably as much about that, yes. Slide 15 talks about how we deliver those services. When people apply for child care assistance, they're going to apply through the mail to our office here in Pierre. However, our licensing staff are located regionally in seven different locations. And then we also have contracts with a network of providers that really help provide some other technical assistance to child care providers to increase their quality. And those providers are called the Early Childhood Enrichment Centers. Slide 16 starts some of our divisions that are primarily engaged and provide services to adults. And first off is our Division of Adult Services and Aging. We provide services through that division to individuals who are age 60 and older and adults with disabilities. Sometimes we get asked why 60? You know, what's the magic of that? Because that doesn't seem very elderly, and that's another term that you'll see come into use within this division. And please know we don't feel that 60 is elderly by any means. That actually is the age designation for one of our primary funding sources within this division, and so it makes sense to kind of align with that. So individuals age 60 and older, and then adults with disabilities. We contract with a variety of providers within this division to provide direct services to folks, again, with a real focus on helping people stay at home. We know people want to stay in their homes, in their communities, as long as possible, and so we try to help people do that through a variety of services and supports. We have in-home services provided to, 6,000 people in a given year. Those agencies, we have a multitude of agencies, and we are, in constant work with them to try to expand what they do, their reach. We give them a lot of credit. They do a lot of good by people in some pretty tough situations. Home-delivered meals and congregate meals, elderly nutrition. Again, I'm sure this group is well aware of the importance that good nutrition is just to overall health. There's also the social benefit, and when people, that might be a little bit isolated, leave their homes and go to a congregate meal site and get to see other people. And so we support those meal programs through this division as well. Transportation, helping older people access transportation, especially in those rural communities, to get to the doctor, to get to the grocery store. We have some funding dedicated to that effort as well. Caregiver support. That's some supportive services that we provide to people that are caring for somebody that can get emotionally and physically wearing. And so we have some limited services available to help those people, be strong and continue to be able to provide that care. Adult day services are provided in a few locations across the state. Again, that's a support to families where we see situations where, maybe the person's spouse or their children are able to care for their family member, but they work during the day, and their adult family member needs some place to go for some supervision, maybe a meal, maybe that socialization aspect, and adult day kind of helps with that need. Adult Protective Services is another function of this division. That's our staff where we play the role of investigating situations where there's an allegation of abuse or neglect or exploitation of an older adult. And so that's a function that we play. Prescription assistance is in there as well. We all know how important it is for people to get the prescriptions that they need, and so we help link people up with any pharmaceutical company programs that they might qualify for, make sure that they're aware of their Medicare Part D options, as well as, you know, sometimes we'll assist people with applying for Medicaid if that seems to be an option. Slide 17 talks about some other services that we work very closely with. Long-term care, nursing homes are a very important part of our system of care. Last year we had 3,591 consumers access nursing home care services that we paid for. Assisted living care is another level of care where people don't have quite the skilled nursing needs that you would see in a nursing home setting, but still need that facility-based level of care, and you see the number of people that we paid for services there as well. Our Adult Services and Aging Division has specialists located in 25 communities throughout the state, and again, they do provide that statewide coverage. The next slide talks about some specific initiatives in this area that some of you are actually very aware of and have helped us participate and shape. And so we'd just like to run through some of those because it impacts some of the things that we're doing right actually today. Back in the 2006 legislature, the legislature approved a bill that authorized our department to proceed with a study of our long-term care system. There was a lot of mutual feeling that we needed to position our state and ourselves to be able to serve people that are going to be aging and going to be needing services in the long term as we see our population age and baby boomer generation really come into this picture. And so we were very pleased for that opportunity, and we contracted with an agency to actually conduct that study that was completed in November of 2007. That study is available through our website. Several of you have seen that. But what it did is really give us a good foundation of data and some trend projection into what we're going to need for services all the way up to 2025. The study also did some work in terms of evaluating kind of where are we as a state relative to our use of existing services, and provided some options for us to move forward to best position ourselves to meet the needs of people in the long term. One of the things that the study specifically found is that South Dakota as a state has a high utilization of facility-based, i.e. nursing home services, and a relatively low utilization rate of other services in the community. That was in comparison to other states, and so that was a major finding that we wanted to look more into and start to strategize around, because not only do we know that people want to stay in their communities and in their homes as long as possible, those are also cheaper services, and so from a financial aspect, it's in our interest to see a robust, you know, community service delivery system there. Moving on from the study, then what we did is we had a large task force come together. We actually had about 100 members come together. It was actually only for about a year, maybe seemed a little bit longer than that some days, but there you go. We had 100 people come together and help us really kind of get at what that long-term care study told us, and they developed recommendations in various areas, but a couple that we wanted to point out to you had to do with home and community-based services and then single point of entry. Specifically, the task force indicated that, you know, it's not, you know, not only do we need to kind of do some work relative to the services that are available and accessible to people really have to know how to access those services. And it's not enough just to have them out there. If people don't know about them or if they don't know how to go about getting them, you know, you really need to pay attention to that as well. And so the task force made some specific recommendations in that area, and they really recommended that based on our population, based on our structure, that we have a single point of entry system so that there's really kind of one common place that people can go, get the information that they need, get some help understanding what their needs maybe really are, and get to the right provider and hopefully pay for that themselves. So single point of entry, the task force went a step further and said that they felt that that kind of function would fall within the Department of Social Services Division of Adult Services and Aging, given what we do on a daily basis already. So what we're doing in this area is outlined on slide 19. And as we were contemplating these issues within South Dakota, we were actually quite consistent with some federal direction in this area, where the federal government was putting out grant opportunities for states to participate in developing what they call aging and disability resource centers. So ADRC, you're going to start to hear that acronym a bit. In our state, we've taken that same acronym, we call it Aging and Disability Resource Connections. As we were talking to people about this kind of concept, we heard from people who said, you know, when you tell me it's Aging and Disability Resource Center, I think that's a place that I go, or it's a, you know, it's kind of like this adult daycare center, and that's not really what this is. So we changed the name a little bit to be Connections, because we see that as really what we're doing in this area. We applied for this grant. We were awarded the grant. It's a 3-year opportunity for us to really develop some infrastructure to be able to help people in ways that we can't do right now. So an example of that is we're developing an online resource database that people are going to be able to eventually search by location to see what services are, you know, closest to them, so that they can help to, you know, understand what those choices are, become better consumers, if you will, help those family members. It's you know, to talk to our ASA staff, they get calls after every holiday period when adult children come home to visit mom and dad from out of state and discover that mom and dad aren't doing as well as they need to be and they need some help. This will be a resource for family members, you know, that are even outside of South Dakota to help their mom and dad get the things that they need so that they can stay at home. But so the grant will help support the development of some of those things that aren't available now. We're also revamping our intake processes so that when we do get those calls that we're getting consistent information from office to office. We're revamping our assessment process so that we're using a standardized tool now that will be very helpful as we help people get directed to the right services. So it's really kind of a systems change effort within our department to really develop best practice in the area supporting people that need long-term care services. The target populations for this effort for us are, again, those people that are over age 60 and then people that are over age 18 who have physical disabilities who also need those long-term care services. Again, the services themselves are very similar. It's just a couple of different populations that tend to need those. We will be, we're launching our first Aging and Disability Resource Connections this month in our Sioux Falls office that will serve Minnehaha, Lincoln, Turner, and McCook counties. We'll be rolling out these ADRCs across the state and have them implemented by October 2012, and we'll have five ADRCs across the state by the time we're done. What we'll be doing is rolling in our current office structure into one of those. The functionality of this is just that makes it easier for people to call us. They don't have to keep track of the 25 offices that we're in. They have to keep track of the 5-800 numbers that they can call to get the help that they need. So we're excited about it, and we've actually had a lot of stakeholder involvement. We were a state that we're participating in this effort later than most other states. The benefit of that is that we've got the benefit of a lot of lessons learned, and so we are taking those to heart, and so we're trying to do this, with the lessons that other states have learned. We've been involving stakeholders from the very beginning, both at the statewide and at the local level, and we've had a lot of corrections in the road as we've gone along, and I think we have a better process as a result of that. So to anybody who has participated in that, we appreciate your efforts. Moving on to the Division of Economic Assistance, this is our division that, like I mentioned, really does impact the most people across the state because they're really the folks that help people access various programs, including Medicaid eligibility. We serve people, low-income families, children and individuals, people that are elderly and people with disabilities. We do Medicaid eligibility. You see how many people that was in an average month last year. We also do eligibility for SNAP, which is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. That is the new name for food stamps. So we're moving into the SNAP world, but if you hear food stamps, that's in fact the same thing. And you can see the number of households that we had there. We have a couple of charts here coming up that show you some of the trends for eligibility in this area, and it will be of no surprise to any of you here, I'm sure, that we're seeing an increase in the numbers of families that are applying for these benefits and eligible. Slide 21 goes through some of the other programs that our Division of Economic Assistance determines eligibility for. We have our low-income energy assistance program. This is where we are able to assist families that are low income and who need help with heating their houses in the winter. This is something, again, where it's similar to child care, where if there's a family that's eligible, we pay the provider directly. So when a family is participating in this, we will actually make the payment to whoever's providing the heat source. That program also helps certain families in certain income situations actually weatherize their houses through contracts with agencies across the state, and that's a good investment to, you know, get at some of those high heating costs and can help take some stress off those family budgets. Temporary assistance for needy families, this commonly known as TANF, so you'll hear that as well. This is a program that has evolved over many, many years and is most closely associated with when people use the term welfare. This is probably what they're thinking about. It used to be ADC or aid to dependent children way back when. Then it was ADFC, aid to dependent families and children. It's now TANF. And I guess what I would share with you all to make sure that you understand is that TANF is a work program. Adults aren't on TANF unless they're working, and we have requirements towards that. And our state does very, very well relative to our work participation rates. If there's people that are in communities where there aren't work opportunities for them, then they're doing community volunteer work so that they're developing work skills so that they will eventually not be on TANF. There's timelines associated with how long a family can be on TANF. There are some minor exceptions to that, but TANF is not a cash payment for people to sit around and live off of the state or federal government. These are federal dollars. I would mention that, although it's our division that does administer them. But, you know, I think because of the evolution of the program and some high-profile anecdotes along the way, there's probably some misperceptions, but it is a work program. It's time limited. And there's actually the other thing I would tell you is that the actual cash payment associated with TANF is probably lower than most people would think. It's less than $400 a month.
Senator Rave.
Question, please.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Secretary, do you ever see a time where the federal dollars dry up for TANF? And do you see that coming anytime soon, or do we continue to believe that will be a totally federal funded program?
Thank you for the question, Senator. We don't have any indication that the federal policy in this area is really slated to change. I think with the current recession, I think there's a good understanding at the federal level how important this is as a safety net program for people that are really struggling. So the dollars that we get in this area have not increased for many, many years, but we don't have any sense that it's going to go away or change in any substantive way either.
Just a quick follow-up or just to finalize. I just more worry about, this is one area I could see where they could maybe feel the need to push the burden off onto the states, or at least we share in a match program, or I don't know, it's just an area of concern I had. I had nothing to base that on, just my overall concern of what's going on at the federal level.
Sure. But if I might respond, the thing I would tell you is that there is a state MOE requirement, so we do have to, you know, put dollars towards this effort. That level has not changed, though, either. So they're not increasing that, which would be of concern for sure.
I'm sorry. I didn't know we had an MOE on TANF. I thought TANF was totally – what is our MOE on TANF? Do you know off the top of your head? You did know that off the top of your head.
Isn't impressed. That great? It's $8.5 million every year.
Million. And how much do we get total, Brenda, do you know?
$21 million in federal.
So the total budget is about $30-ish million. Okay, thank you.
I just have a few questions somewhat on that line. On those people that are participating in that program, what's the conversion rate that they have jobs at the completion of that program?
The way that that's measured is not upon the completion of the program, but while a person is participating and getting the benefit, I believe it's a 50% participation rate. I'm looking back at, okay. If I might, I would ask Carrie to come up and she can tell you more than I sure can. Well, while Carrie comes up, what she was indicating is that there is a federal participation requirement for that, and we're measured on that on a regular basis, and that's something that all states are required to show.
The question that I asked is, for people that are on the program, then when they're no longer on the program, what's the conversion rate that they're now in a position or in a job?
Carrie Johnson, I'm the Division Director for Economic Assistance. I'll have to get that information. We do have that, though.
Then my other question is this. Realizing, especially in the rural areas, that one of the challenges out there isn't an available workforce. Part of it is the jobs that are out in that area. How do you work, or do you interface with the private sector or whatever? Because, you know, I'm hitting on an area, and I'll tell you, it's the community-based services, that they need individuals working in those programs. It's a challenge. So I'm wondering, and from past experience, trying to target that program, we can't find anybody. And so that's what I'm wondering, how to balance those, you know, that there are opportunities. They're not at a, you know, we know what the reimbursement is, so I guess it's a long question, but how have you done anything with the private sector to get those people in the rural areas into programs, especially healthcare areas?
Yeah, I mean, we look for any opportunity that there is in those particular areas, and again, it's going to depend on the area. What's available, but we work with other agencies, state agencies, federal agencies, tribal agencies, wherever we can in the community to, again, it may be a community service site or it may be an actual position that can work into a full-time job. The percentage of which of those they land in, I will be able to provide. I don't have that at my fingertips right now.
One last question in that area. Does a person have the choice that if something was available but they said, nope, I'm not interested in that, do they have a choice then not to get into something? If there's limited choices and it's not anything that I want to do, do I have a choice to stay on the program and not and wait and to see if something else shows up?
No. No, you don't. What we try to do, though, is to address any of the barriers that are your concern. So if you're saying it's hard for me to get to that work site because I need daycare or because I have travel concerns or whatever the case may be, we try to address those barriers to help you get there.
Thank you.
And we're always looking to find the job that best works for you. Everybody has different levels of skills and abilities, so it's a process. To work with that individual and find out what it is that they're good at and what their greatest potential will be in and to help them find the work site that best meets that.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
As I mentioned, this division, is a common way that people interact with us, and so not only do we help people access services that we might administer, we also refer them to other agencies. And so that's a very common part of our daily business. Our staff really, I do think, have a very good understanding of the resources that are available outside of state and federal programs. Education assistance for 557 youth at risk. This is a little bit different kind of deal. What this is where children are in state custody, whether that's the Department of Social Services or the Department of Corrections, and they are placed in a facility, and don't have a school district because they're in the state's custody, and we have to make that so the state basically becomes their school district and makes that tuition payment when they're in a paid placement. So it's called the Auxiliary Placement Program, and it just happens to be housed within this division. The other thing that we do here is we work with community action programs that are located throughout the state, and those are a provider of some very basic safety net services for really the poorest of the poor. The last point here, again, speaks to the integrity of the staff in this area. They are very, very good at what they do, and the federal government has recognized our state with bonus payments in our SNAP program for the low level of error that they make and the high accuracy rate that we enjoy. We provide services through all of the offices that you saw on that map through this division. So we have EA staff in all of those offices. Slide 22 just shows you kind of what's happening with our SNAP trend line in terms of what we've seen here. And as the chart obviously shows, you know, we were seeing some growth, but not, you know, a large growth trend all the way up until fiscal year 09. And then when the recession hit, we saw a much larger growth rate starting in fiscal year 09, and that is projected out through this year. Again, not probably hugely surprising to anybody in this room.
Madam Secretary, just with the overall SNAP program, do you do any things with other departments so that if I'm a family on there in working with them, refer them to another programs like Extension Service that talks about gardening or things like that so that they have some other options out there, not totally dependent upon the SNAP program for food products and that?
That's a really good question, a really good point, Senator. And I should have alluded to this earlier. The SNAP program is designed and intended to be part of the food solution for a family. So what people get in SNAP benefits was never intended to be a family's entire grocery budget. And so by necessity, families do need to you know, supplement that. And so we do have some educational opportunities through the extension, actually, to help families with those kinds of matters. Yeah. Slide 23 is the trend line for the TANF program. And you'll see, again, a similar kind of dynamic where actually not much growth at all between fiscal year 7 and fiscal year 9. In fact, we even saw a drop within fiscal year 8. But then starting in 9, we see that trend start to accelerate again. And so, you know, again, very causal relationship from the recession, and we're looking forward to the days when we don't see that trend line continue. This is not something we'd like to see.
Madam Secretary, still on that, I'm into cross relations with departments. Mm-hmm. With the TANF program, then do they have opportunity if they're on there to say take some education courses or take some?
Yes.
So do you interface then with Ed, and do you interface with with the Department of Labor? We just had a stimulus program this past summer that.
Very much so. The Department of Labor is a major partner with us to administer the TANF program in that they help find jobs for people in non-reservation counties. So they are the people that are helping folks know what their options are. They don't get a choice to not work, but to the degree that there are more than one work and or school option available to a family, then they have to make one of those choices. So Department of Labor is very much a partner with us. And, you know, we do work with community, employment and volunteer training opportunities day in and day out. That's what our staff in the field really do relative to this program.
Just to follow up, and I don't need it, and I know you're going to provide me some data. I would really like some in-depth data about this program, you know, a little bit of a more review of it, of the participants, at least for the past year, who have, as I said, converted over, and just some other demographic pieces in there to describe this population, and also what other departments or programs you work with
with people to get
Senator,
them.
One of the things that we'll make sure to include, Senator, is the wage that a person's making when they do leave our program. We have data on all of that, the number that get health insurance. I mean, we strive to get people into positions that are going to sustain them after they leave our program, obviously, and to the degree that health insurance can be part of that, that's a good thing, too.
Senator Krause.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In related to that question from the chair, I know the Social Security disability folks are, that's a federal program, but some of those people also need this help in terms, I think, a little shove to get to work and to get the right nutrition, et cetera. Is there any way that we can help, or do we already interface with those folks?
Thank you, Senator Krause, for that question. I guess what I would say is that if a person has been determined to be disabled at the from the Social Security Administration, then there's been a determination that work is not part of their future, or at least at that time. And so I don't know that TANF and is geared towards that population as much as people that don't have disabilities that are in fact able to work. So usually by the time a person has qualified for SSI or SSDI, there's been that disability determination that includes the person's ability to work as part of that. But that's not to say that certainly people with disabilities don't work and shouldn't work, and so we obviously assist people. It's just probably not our target population.
Senator Schleckaway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be really brief. Madam Secretary, when you talked about the SNAP program, going back to that, it got me thinking about the sales tax on food refund program. That's been a topic that we've all been subject to the last several years. What are the challenges in terms of utilization? We're always told not enough people are utilizing it. Mm-hmm. It seems like a relatively simple and straightforward process to apply. Is there anything that can be done to increase utilization of that? I don't want to put you on the spot. I know that's a broad question, but that's been an issue the last several years, my whole time in the legislature.
Sure. Thank you, Senator, for that question. We have throughout the throughout that entire program have worked on that issue about making sure that people know about it and are accessing it. I do think that our sense is that people don't feel, we've tried to minimize the processes to make it as easy, as possible for people. The way that the benefit is administered is something that's easy for people to use. I mean, we've kind of looked at it at all angles to try to make it as simple as possible. And I think it's our feeling that, nevertheless, that the amount of money that people actually get back, because it's related to what they would have paid for sales tax on food, is just maybe not enough for them to go through those steps.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In that program, how much flexibility do you have in the employer? What we run into is some employers who were determined not eligible to train someone under the TANF program. Are you pretty much tied by federal laws in this case?
Senator, thank you for your question. We do have to comply with federal requirements for what constitutes meeting that work requirement, including those employers. And so we can sure get you some more information about what those requirements are. But, yeah, these come to us from the federal government. being mindful of the time constraints that we have, I'd like to move on, if I might, to the Division of Medical Services. You know, we always kind of we get particular about when do we talk about Medicaid, because you know, this really is a big part of our department, both really monetarily, and it's usually at the top of people's minds when they think about what we do as a department. But the Division of Medical Services, through the Medicaid state plan, provides services for elderly individuals and people with disabilities, certain low-income children, pregnant women, adults and families, and children in foster care. All of the services that we pay for through the Medicaid program have to be medically necessary and physician ordered. We commonly refer to having kind of the big four services. So if you ever hear the big four in this context, that means inpatient and outpatient hospital, physician services, and prescription drugs. And those four really account for, you know, over 70% of all of our service costs in this area. However, we provide other services, and those include clinic, lab, x-ray, and that entire list there. We have close to 10,500 providers of Medicaid across our state. And the thing I would tell you sincerely is that the providers, the healthcare providers in South Dakota, I would put up against any state relative to helping people that need health care. We enjoy really good access for people that are on Medicaid across the state. We have some places to improve, but by and large, our providers step up, and for that, we are very, very grateful. They are great partners for us to administer this program. Slide 25 talks about the average number of people that are that were eligible in fiscal year 10 by category. And know that obviously we have a number of people that are on every month, but over the, you know, people come on and come off. And over the course of last year, we served close to 140,000 people. Slide 26 has some handy facts to kind of help put all of that into a larger context. Nearly one in seven people get their health care coverage through Medicaid or CHIP. Children are the bulk of this. So two-thirds of the people that we serve are, in fact, kids that are in families that either don't have health care or are too poor to afford it. One in three children under the age of 19 in our state are covered through Medicaid or CHIP, and actually it's a little bit higher than that. It's 37%. 50% of the kids that are born in South Dakota will have their health care coverage through Medicaid or CHIP in their first year of life. 27 shows you a chart of what that trend line has looked like. Again, same old story. We saw moderate growth, you know, even a, you know, a slow rate of growth up until fiscal year 9, but then we've seen a much higher trend since that point. Slide 28 is another picture of what our population looks like. A couple of things I'd point out for you is in the box off to the right, you'll see 21, the yellow there, children. That's actually our CHIP program. That's Title 21 and CHIP are the same thing. So if you hear those two terms, that's the same group. And then 19, which you see for Title 19 children, Title 19 adults, that's Medicaid. But what you can see between the yellow and the light blue is that children are the bulk of who we serve in the Medicaid program. So, again, this isn't lazy adults not choosing to, you know, be upstanding citizens. These are poor kids or kids with disabilities for the most part that don't have other options.
Madam Secretary, do you just want to differentiate? You did a little bit here at the end between the CHIP and the Medicaid for the children. What would make the difference? Why would I be in one and not in the other?
One difference would be your insurance status. If you have access to insurance, then you're not eligible for CHIP. And we do see a lot of people that are eligible for Medicaid and CHIP. Parents are working. They have some health insurance, but Medicaid is a secondary payer in those kinds of situations. So the insurance status is one, and then the income level is the other. At the very end of this presentation, you have a federal poverty level chart that you might find as a handy reference if you're ever interested in terms of the income levels for the various programs that we administer. That includes in there the CHIP, Title 21, and then the Title 19 levels. Slide 29 talks about some key short-term issues serving vulnerable people in our communities. continues to be a theme. You've heard that already. It will continue to be a challenge for us in the short and long term. Serving more people, more and more people without additional staff. That's a, you know, that's a thing that we're dealing with and have now for the past couple of years. Successfully transitioning behavioral health services to the Department of Social Services. You heard in Governor Dugard's State of the State address of some reorganizational plans in this area. We're really excited by this opportunity to help integrate those services and to see outcomes for people with behavioral health challenges. There's a lot of overlap in populations between our departments and the services that we provide, and so we're excited to work on this with our colleagues at the Department of Human Services. Lastly, we have implementing healthcare reform, and so we have a couple of slides that talk about how this whole area will impact our department. Slide 30 starts there with what our biggest impact will be, and that's to our Medicaid program. The Federal Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, or now known as the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, will really impact our department in a major way in that we will see a large number of people who aren't eligible for Medicaid now become eligible. Medicaid eligibility, I mean, we could talk for 2 hours just about the intricacies of that, but not only is it income-based, but you have to be in a certain category of people that our state has elected to cover. And those are people, most of the people that we do cover are people that we have to cover per federal regulation. Those are people with disabilities, those are older adults, those are very, very low-income families. What the ACA does is it takes away some of those distinctions and goes to a more uniform income-based determination process for Medicaid eligibility. What that means is that we're going to see we're estimating 52,000 people that are not eligible now become eligible for Medicaid by 2020. Those new eligibles, however, will not necessarily get the same benefit package or the same services that people on Medicaid get now. So that'll require us to, define what those essential health benefits are. That's actually the lingo. And in effect, run two different, insurance programs, if you will. And so there's some challenges with that. The federal government will be paying for the service costs for this newly eligible population in total for the first 2 years that they're eligible. And then the federal part, or the federal participation, decreases and gets down to the point of 90% by 2020. So there is enhanced federal participation in the costs for this new eligible group. But even though it's, pretty robust, we expect the state to have additional costs as well to the tune of just shy of $100 million by 2020. That's cumulative. That's not per year. The other thing I would add is that there's no enhanced funding for additional administrative costs. Those are paid at a rate of 50-50 right now. And obviously when we're, adding that many people, we're going to have some additional administrative costs associated with that. We'll be having to produce and we'll develop and produce a website for people to be able to apply online and be enrolled directly through that website, which is not a functionality that we have right now. That website is also going to have to be linked to any efforts that the state has relative to developing its exchange. So there's some integration that we're going to be working on. The healthcare reform really changes not only who's eligible, but how we determine eligibility. And again, that's a thing it gets pretty technical pretty quickly. It doesn't seem on its surface that would be, that big of a deal, just change your numbers, whatever. It is a big deal. Our systems, our technology systems are all geared around a certain way of looking at certain information, and this really kind of changes all of that. So big change is coming. Implementation of the healthcare exchange. We, because of the links to Medicaid, are an agency that is clearly affected by the healthcare exchange. The exchange is really just that marketplace for people to go to either apply for and enroll in Medicaid. That's a function of the exchange. So people can either come to us or to the exchange, and if they're eligible, get on Medicaid. The exchange will also help a person determine eligibility for an access federal tax credit. credits if they fall into those income ranges. So that's another function of the exchange. And then the exchange will help people that don't fall into either of those two groups to actually just know what their options are and be that link to purchase insurance on their own. So because of the role of Medicaid with the exchange, we're working very close, we're working on developing kind of what that needs to look like. But we know that there's going to be changes to what we do, as a result of that. We are part of the exchange planning grant, that the state has. And so, that's been and will be a good mechanism for us to kind of get some of those questions answered. The next page isn't, just to kind of put on your radar, we're not as concerned about these next two pieces because they're kind of in a state of flux. The CLASS Act is CLASS stands for the Community Living Assistance Services and Supports Program. This is a national voluntary insurance program to help people get dollars to support their long-term care needs, as it were, in the event that they need assistance. It's not something that we would have to administer. However, the state would have a role in determining kind of the provider capacity in this area. But the federal government has a lot to work out on this. If this does come to fruition and is successful, it could have some positive impacts on Medicaid and could possibly be a good resource for people to purchase services that they need and not maybe rely on us. The Elder Justice Act implementation will have a significant impact on us. The caveat here is that it hasn't been appropriated. I don't know that I'd be betting anybody that it will be appropriated, but if it does, we will see some significant resource come to our state in the form of, for the specific purposes of state ombudsman programs and adult protective services. So we'll obviously keep those. They're on our radar, and we'll be sure to keep people informed as they develop. The last slide there is, as I mentioned, that the federal poverty level guidelines and where some of our major programs, kind of where those fall within that rubric. So that's usually a handy guide for people.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. My apologies to the committee and to you. We always end up with questions and that. But I also recall that you are subject to come back to us. So I will assure you that right.
Subject or invited?
I didn't leave that in my other area. So I think that there will be some opportunity, especially after we hear the governor's budget address, and there are some other areas here to
Absolutely. Maybe
come back. So we would like to extend that because I think the last piece, the medical services, certainly has an impact. And I know I have more questions, and I'm sure the committee does, so we'll look at another opportunity. Thank you for your timeliness, and thank the department for coming. And these are all challenging times, and they're also very great times in the sense that hopefully we're going to redesign a system that will enhance the delivery of the services and coordination, and they don't have to be costly for the taxpayers of South Dakota. And I applaud you on your efforts that you're doing, and look forward that we can continue on.
Thank you.
Great. Anything else? With that, again, thank you. We will get out of here by 11:15. I would entertain. Oh, one other thing. Things don't change either. Any handouts, three holes, please. That came with me, too. So, unfortunately, you'll have to deal with that. With that, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Second.
Moved by Senator Schleckway, seconded by Senator Rabe. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carried. Thank you. Have a great 3-day weekend.